Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to Sound Synchronicity on Now Time Radio.
All aboard!
From the East, House of Light, may wisdom dawn in us, so we may see all things in clarity. From the North, House of Night, may wisdom ripen in us, so we may see all from within. From the West, House of Transformation, may wisdom be transformed into right action, so we may do what must be done. south, house of the eternal sun. May right action reap the harvest, so we may enjoy the fruits of planetary being. From above, house of heaven, where star people and ancestors gather, may their blessings come to us now. Below, house of earth, may the heartbeat of her crystal core bless us with harmonies to end all war. From the center, galactic source, which is everywhere at once, may everything be known as the light of mutual love. Ayum Hunabku Eva Maya E Maho. Ayum Hunabku Eva Maya E Maho. Ayum Hunabku Eva Maya E Ma ho.
In Lakesh, listeners all over the planet, greetings and welcome to another episode of Sound Synchronicity on Now Time Radio. I'm your host, Makua Nine Kimi Ray, and so grateful to be here this evening. We have such a show lined up this evening, and I'm excited as here we are in what is actually referred to as the Red Spectral Dragon Day, the first Red Dragon solar seal of the Red Dragon Chinese New Year. So alignments happen all around, and certainly a time of purification, a time of renewal, a time for personal and planetary renewal. So grateful to welcome you all to the show at this time. I'd like to share actually the energy for today. It says, I dissolve in order to nurture, releasing being. I seal the input of birth with the spectral tone of liberation. I am guided by my own power doubled. So what a wonderful acknowledgement of the power of birth, all of being, and the nurturance and liberation within and around. I know that this is certainly a very interesting episode for me, as I am broadcasting from a little bay near the harbor in Vancouver, British Columbia. So last week, somewhere in California, I actually don't even remember right now, but I find myself here in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm certainly grateful for the show that is to be in for listeners tuning in. Terry Kinn. Tonight's guest is a renowned author, researcher, lecturer, known for just many important works in connecting the African presence all throughout the world, and particularly the studies in Kemet, also known as Egypt. So we're very happy to have Brother Anthony T. Browder on the program this evening. We'll be bringing him on. But in the meantime, what I'd like to do, actually, in preparation for the discussion with Brother Tony Browder, is play a little bit of Earth, Wind, and Fire. I thought it was appropriate. This is actually one of my favorite EWF songs, entitled In the Stone. And there's they'll understand more directly how this relates to the theme and to the information and inspiration which Brother Browder is bringing to light for listeners and audiences all over the world. So we're grateful for that. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Synchronicity on Now. And enjoy this Earth, Wind, and Fire selection, In the Stone. Hotep. That's right. It's written in the stone, the truth, the knowledge of the antiquities for all to see and experience and prayerfully come to really understand and appreciate what the ancient ones were sharing us. And what a fitting intro I think that makes for tonight's guest. I'm so excited to welcome this brother, this elder and Baba to the show tonight. Anthony T. Browder is an author, publisher, cultural historian, artist, and an educational consultant. A graduate of Howard University's College of Fine Arts, he has lectured extensively throughout the United States, Africa, the Caribbean, Mexico, Japan, and Europe on issues related to African and African-American history and culture. Mr. Browder is also the founder and director of IKG Cultural Resources, Information, Knowledge, and Growth, and has devoted 30 years researching ancient Egyptian history, science, philosophy, and culture. He's traveled to Egypt 47 times since 1980 and is currently director of the ASA Restoration Project, which is funding the excavation and restoration of the 25th Dynasty tomb of Kara Khamun in Luxor, Egypt. Browder is the first African American to fund and coordinate an archaeological dig in Egypt and has led 5 archaeological missions to Egypt since 2009. Well, that is certainly a remarkable, just a remarkable feat, I would say, and certainly an incredible host of contributions being made by Tony Browder. I want to welcome you to the show in Lakesh, Tony Browder.
Thank you so much, my brother. It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience. And again, I want to thank you for the wonderful job you did at our cultural center last month, where you gave a fascinating presentation on the significance of 2012, brother, and people are still talking about it.
Wonderful. That was a remarkable thing we all spent together, and it was certainly a synchronicity that Ms. Aziza Keynes invited me to come out that night to share exactly 1 year from the prophesied end date of the Mayan long count, December 1st. What a remarkable time I certainly had, and it was a true pleasure to share with the audience. And in that, we discovered that, in fact, you are a white spectral wizard as your galactic signature. And I think that that's certainly a remarkable signature and certainly telling for your purpose as it relates to helping liberate people, liberate the minds of people. And I'm very excited to learn more about this amazing discovery, Henry, what you all have been doing in Egypt, in Kemet specifically. I think this is just really, really incredible. So I'd love for you, in fact, to tell us a little bit about this priest's tomb and just a little bit of the background and how it even came about that you all discovered this.
Sure. Well actually, the credit for the rediscovery of this tomb belongs to my colleague, Dr. Lena Pishtikova, who is a Russian-born, U.S.-trained Egyptologist. She is one of the foremost experts on the art and history of the 25th Dynasty, and had been working for a number of years restoring a tomb in Egypt, and a 26th Dynasty tomb in Egypt, and in her spare time, she was searching for this lost tomb of Kara Khamun, 25th Dynasty tomb, that was first discovered in the 1820s by 2 British men, and then was first documented by a German Egyptologist in the 1840s, and was last visited by an Austrian Egyptologist in the 1970s, and then the tomb disappeared. It's on the western bank of Luxor, and through some investigation on her part, Dr. Pishtikova discovered the location of this tomb in 2005, and then proceeded the following year to begin excavating this tomb. And she has uncovered a remarkable tomb, which is the second Kushite tomb built in Egypt. The Kushites were Africans from Sudan who came into Egypt and established what is now known as the 25th dynasty, which unfortunately many people refer to as the African dynasty, when in point of fact, all of the dynasties of ancient Kemet from the earliest times until the Persian invasion were all African dynasties. But the 25th dynasty specifically was founded by Africans from Kush, or what is now modern-day Sudan. A traditional Egyptologist acknowledged them as being the only authentic black African rulers of Egypt. But what's significant about this discovery in the 8th century B.C. is that these African rulers came into Kemet, the country that we now refer to as Egypt, specifically to drive out invaders, Libyan invaders specifically, and to restore the land of their ancestors. These Kushite kings established what many Egyptologists acknowledge was the first renaissance in history. Not only did these Africans drive out the invaders, but they restored peace and harmony to the land. They rebuilt temples, monuments. They did this by reaching back, by engaging in an act of Sankofa, and reaching back into their ancestral history 2,000 years to an era that is referred to as the Old Kingdom. That is the time frame in which all of the great pyramids of Egypt were built, the 4th, 5th, and 6th dynasties. That is when the pyramid texts were first written. That is when ancient Kemet produced the magnificent structures, monuments, that still attract millions of people to Egypt every year to see what these ancient Africans created. And it just so happens that this tomb that we're excavating was built during the reign of the second ruler of the 25th dynasty, Shabaka. This priest by the name of Karakamun had the distinction of being the first Ankh priest at Karnak Temple. The Ankh priest is the priest responsible for saying the morning libations to evoke the name of the Creator, to draw his spirit into the Holy of Holies. And Karnak Temple is the largest temple complex ever built by humans on the planet. It is where the shrine or the Holy of Holies of the Netzer, or the principal deity, Amen, resided. Amen is a ancient Kemetic word that means the hidden or unseen presence of God. That term, Amen, is still used by Jews and Christians and Muslims to this very day, and still speaks to the power of ancient Kemetic and Kushite Netzeru. Karakamun's job was to perform this ritual every morning to evoke the spirit of Amen into this sacred space, where the spirit would literally inspire the 80,000 people who worked in this environment on a daily basis. Karakamun died and was buried on the west bank of Luxor. His tomb was the second Kushite tomb ever built in Egypt, and this was about 2,700 years ago. And as I said, the tomb was first discovered by Europeans in the 1820s. It was then rediscovered by a German Egyptologist, Richard Lepsius, the person responsible for introducing to the Western world the term the Book of the Dead. Lepsius referred to these ancient Kemetic papyri that were found buried with kings and queens and noblemen. He referred to them as Das Totenbuch, or more specifically, the Book of the Dead, the writings that were buried with the dead. But this name is very misleading, specifically when we realize that the Kemetic name for these texts were Pet Em Heru, or the texts for coming forth by day. More specifically, the words to be said by the deceased in order to reanimate your spirit so that you can be reborn in heaven and live again. So we find in Karakamun's tomb these sacred words, passages from Peret Em Heru that were carved on the walls of his tomb, specific texts from the Book of the Hours, the Book of the Days, the Book of the Nights, and we discovered in 2010 texts that are known as the Pyramid Texts. Specifically, the Pyramid Texts date back to the 5th Dynasty, more specifically the 5th Dynasty Pyramid of Unas, the first tomb in which these so-called pyramid texts were recorded. And that name pyramid text is again somewhat misleading because these texts were not carved on pyramids, but were literally carved on the walls of the tombs that were buried beneath the pyramid. These pyramid texts are significant in that they are the oldest texts ever recorded that specifically speaks to the words that the souls of the deceased must say in order to be reborn, and the process of the judgment of the soul of the deceased, and they describe the path that the deceased, the spirit of the deceased, takes in order to be reborn in heaven. All of this is part of the ancient Kemetic legacy, and what we have found in our tomb, the tomb of Karakamun, is that all of this text is recorded in his tomb, which means that in the 8th century B.C., these Kushite priests, kings, and noblemen had preserved the legacy of their ancestors in Kush. And even after Kemet had fallen on hard times, they came back into Kemet, restored the land of their ancestors, and then wrote the sacred texts of their ancestors in their temples, monuments, and tombs. And this is what we are privileged now to be in the midst of uncovering, documenting, and sharing with the world.
I mean, this is absolutely remarkable, and it's certainly, it's very compelling just to understand and greatly appreciate the contributions of the African presence. I mean, in these parts, I'm quite fascinated by your telling of the essentially the misinterpretations of these things, such as there's a major difference in saying the Book of the Dead and then the Book of Coming Forth by Day. That just has a completely different feeling altogether.
Sure.
So it's really a beautiful thing to know that people like yourself are out here and helping to bring clarity to many of these recoveries of these ancient and very, very important relics, these sacred relics. In fact, in looking at the imagery, I noticed in some images I saw online where there was the image of Karakamun on the wall, and I'm assuming that was in the temple structure or in that area, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But that it's very interesting that you actually quite favor this person as well. So I think
that carving is in the tomb portion of his complex, and there is a tomb portion which we've excavated, which is comprised of two rooms, and then there's a temple portion that is attached to the tomb, which we've just begun excavating at the end of the season, last year's season in August. But let me just backtrack for a second and acknowledge the fact that the work that I'm doing is not unlike the work that you're doing, brother, in terms of correcting the misinterpretations of ancient history. The presentation that you did last month talked about the Maya understanding of their calendars and what 2012 literally means. It is not the end of the world, as has been presented in the media, particularly in terrible films or in many articles. It's not the end of the world. It's someone's interpretation of ancient knowledge, and so we have a responsibility for those of us who have taken up the mantle to study ancient texts and ancient history. We have a responsibility to correct these errors so that knowledge and truth can be shared among people who are searching for a clear word in order to get a better understanding of the world that we have inherited and how we can use this understanding in order to create, make this world a better place. But, you know, I have been told that there is a resemblance between myself and Karaka Moon, and I appreciate that. I've been told by several people that I may, in fact, be the reincarnation of Karaka Moon. That's a wonderful...
I'm glad you said it.
that's a wonderful thought to consider. And I'm very open to receive that that suggestion, because there is a draw, there is an attraction. As you mentioned in my introduction, that I've been to Egypt 47 times over the last 31 years, and I'm truly now beginning to understand that all of my travels to Egypt have been preparing me for the work that I'm doing right now. And if you talk to my colleague, Dr. Pishtikova, she would tell you that in the 4 years that we have been involved in this project, and the 4 years since we established the ASA Restoration Project, which is the vehicle through which we are raising funds and recruiting people to come to Egypt with us and participate in this project, over the past 40 years, we've made some phenomenal discoveries, and that whenever we come, things are found, things happen. So I would like to think that that maybe Karaka Moon was waiting until we began coming there to begin to reveal the secrets that he wants the world to know.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, I suppose the word paranormal things that are coming to light, particularly during this era that we're currently blessed to be part of, and we're discovering across the board that there are just many wonderful things that generally would be considered unusual. So it certainly does not surprise me in the least that you would have more than an affinity for this particular priest and nobleman, as I saw written in some of the articulation about Karaka Moon. So it's really a profound thing. I mean, you certainly do favor him, absolutely. Let me ask you a question. When, 31 years ago, when you first went to Kemet, what was the draw there? How was it that you were even led to go there?
Well, that was in 1980. And at that time, it was a dream of the lifetime of a lifetime for me. I'm so pleased that you played Earth, Wind, and Fire at the top of this show, because Earth, Wind, and Fire, Maurice White and Verdine, they really got their start in Chicago, and I'm from Chicago as well. And I had a true affinity for the music and for the messages in the music, for the artwork on their covers. That for many years, specifically after the Spirit LP, I believe in 1977, from the Spirit LP on, all of the albums featured pyramids and Kemetic symbols, and that just increased my interest in Egypt. And it was around that same time, 1977, that I learned for the first time in my life, 3 years after college, that the ancient Egyptians were black. And so I'm now beginning to connect African people to this phenomenal culture that had been literally erased from my consciousness. So as I began reading more about, and let me backtrack for a second, the person responsible for bringing to my awareness the historical reality that the ancient Kemites were black African was Dr. Ivan Van Sertima. Who in 1977 published his book, They Came Before Columbus, The African Presence in America, which connects very much, my brother, with the work that you're doing. So it was hearing Van Sertima, reading his book, and then beginning to read the work of other scholars who also had documented the African origins of ancient Kemet. I became aware of Dr. Yosef Ben-Yekonen, who was one of the foremost scholars of ancient Egyptian history. And Dr. Ben had been conducting study tours to Egypt since the 1960s. And I had an opportunity in December of 1980 to travel to Egypt with Dr. Ben. And those 13 days that I spent on the Nile changed my life forever and made me aware that there was a history that had been, again, distorted and erased from my memory. I had the opportunity to see with my own eyes images of Africans carved on the walls of temples and tombs and monuments, and to be able to travel throughout all of Egypt and to piece together this fractured story of ancient African people, and to know very clearly that this was an indigenous African civilization. So when I returned to Washington, D.C., where I now reside, I created a second company, the Institute of Karmic Guidance, as a vehicle through which I could share my research of ancient Egyptian history. And we have been doing that for well over 30 years. And it's been the vehicle through which I have done my presentations, been sponsoring annual study tours to Egypt since 1987. I have published a number of books on ancient Egyptian history and culture and its influences on Western culture and civilization. And all of this work has led to the work that I'm doing now with the excavation of the tomb of Karakamun. And I understand now very clearly that there is no such thing as coincidence. There is no chance coincidence or accident in the universe ruled by law and divine order. Everything happens for a reason. And that
absolutely,
all souls are born with a specific purpose. And the job of
mm-hmm.
any society is to help young souls realize why they are here so that they can fulfill their
mm-hmm.
work. And I understand now, better now than at any point in my life, that I was born to do the work that I'm doing right now, and that there are many wonderful things in store for me as I continue this this excavation and additional research.
Absolutely. I have to certainly say that I've benefited greatly from your literature. Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization is one of the first books that I picked up that really opened my eyes to the very truth that you're sharing with listeners right now, as you discovered coming out of Howard University that the first Egyptians were actually of African origin, were black people. And that book, you know, I found it in many of my friends' bookshelves. That book has certainly inspired many of my generation to seek more knowledge of self and to understand this connection, this relationship. And as you said, also the purpose, that we're here on purpose, that we have something great to continue as well as contribute in the spirit of our ancestors. So it's a remarkable thing. I'd like to ask you actually a little bit about something you're known for quite well, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area, and this is something I've also had the chance to participate with in the past, and that's the Nile, sorry, the Yes, absolutely. That is incredible. A little bit about that. Now, how long have you been doing that particular tour?
we refer to this activity as a field trip to distinguish it from the tours of Washington, D.C., which primarily focus on American history, culture, and buildings. Our field trip is an experience which shows a direct correlation between the architecture, science, philosophy of ancient Kemet, and how this knowledge was intentionally used by America's founding fathers in order to create what has become the capital of the wealthiest, most powerful nation in human history. So if you understand that there are no accidents, everything happens for a reason. And people who are in control of their destiny make it a point to study history, their history, world history, everyone's history, and then use the knowledge that they uncover in order to determine how they will move through the world. And this is what America's founding fathers did. And the evidence of this work is very clear to those people who understand that history. We refer to this activity, this field trip, as Secrets Hidden in Plain Sight. And we show people during the 3-hour field trip that we do around the city that the history of ancient African people, the history of Nile Valley culture and civilization, has literally been hidden in plain sight. And it's been disconnected from African people, so we attribute African things to non-African people. I first created the field trip in 1986, and we have done thousands of field trips since then. You know, one vivid example of what I'm referring to is the Washington Monument. It is a ubiquitous symbol that upon seeing it, anyone automatically recognizes it as belonging to Washington, D.C., belonging to George Washington, the first president of the United States. But those who have a deeper understanding of African history, of Nile Valley history and culture, will recognize that symbol that is known as the Washington Monument is more than what it is referred to in its, by its Greek name, an obelisk. It is more than an obelisk. It is, in fact, a tekken. Tekken is an ancient Kemetic word, ancient Egyptian word, that was used to describe an identical monument, which was literally carved out of one solid piece of stone, and not 3,300 blocks of stone, as is the Washington Monument. But the tekken was a symbol that was created over 5,000 years ago. It was a symbol that represented the resurrection of Asar, who was the founding father of ancient Kemet. It is a symbol of the resurrection, the first resurrection story recorded in human history. And so it's quite fitting then that in order for Americans to honor their founding father, they chose a symbol that was also established to honor the founding father of ancient Kemet. And again, this idea of resurrection, of rebirth, is old as time. And so we're talking not just about the physical rebirth of a person, but the mental rebirth of their accomplishments that inspires people to act, to think in a manner similar to the person that they are honoring. And so all of these philosophies can be traced back to the Nile Valley, and what we do on the field trip and what I've done in my book, Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization, is to trace back to the origins of many things that have been attributed to the Greeks, the Romans, French, British, and even Americans, to show that it was built on a foundation that was established in the Nile Valley thousands of years ago.
Absolutely. So important to certainly reclaim those visions to their rightful heir, because obviously if people like you didn't come along and the great scholars who precede you to help correct and right the wrongs, we might still be living in the ignorance as if these contributions were not made by Africans. I think that's certainly important. I think it's also fitting that we're in the time of all things being revealed. So those things which have been done in the dark are coming to light, and that's such a blessing to be here for that. I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit also on the field trip. One of the things that really stood out to me is when you took us to the Library of Congress, and we actually looked at the many faces that surround the Library of Congress building, if I'm remembering correctly. And there was something significant about that, because I remember that there were faces representing, you know, all of humanity, basically, the different, the different brute races and things. And I was wondering, there was something significant, though, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, there was, how many faces were of African origin, if I'm remembering correctly?
Okay, well, let me put the pieces together for you. The Library of Congress was built in 1897. It is the oldest cultural institution in Washington, D.C. It houses the largest collection of knowledge in the world. They have over 65 million artifacts within the three buildings that comprise the Library of Congress, and they receive 22,000 items every single week. So when this The main building of the Library of Congress, the Thomas Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress, was created in 1897. There were a series of heads carved around the building on the first floor level. They're known as the 33 ethnological heads, and they were created to represent the 33 races of mankind. Now, what's significant about these heads is the placement of the heads around the four corners of the building. And so in the field trip, we talk about the significance of shapes, the significance of numbers, specifically their relationship to masonry. We also talk about the African origins or the Nile Valley origins of masonry. And for those who have studied Scottish Rite Order masonry knows that there are 32 degrees of masonry. The 33rd degree is the highest degree. And as a matter of fact, one of the places where we stop on this study tour is the House of the Temple on the corner of 16th and S Street, Northwest Washington, which is the headquarters, the international headquarters for all 33rd degree Masons on the planet. It is a building that is flanked by a pair of sphinxes on either side of the doorway. It is a building that has on its second floor level 33 pillars, which are 33 feet high and surround the temple room where Masons are initiated into the 33rd degree. And on top of the building, atop the temple room, is a step pyramid, which is comprised of 13 steps, that pays homage to Imhotep, the designer, the architect of the step pyramid, the very first building ever created by Masons or builders of stone thousands of years ago. So at the Library of Congress, we have the exterior of the Thomas Jefferson Building is surrounded by 33 heads, which has an association with masonry, 33rd degree masonry. And then the heads are grouped around the building in an interesting pattern. You have four heads at the eastern entrance to the building. Four heads at the eastern entrance of the building that represent the four European races, the blonde European, the brunette European, the Russian Slav, and the modern Greek. And then on each of the four corners of the building, you have a series of three heads who represent the various races. You've got the Iranian, the Hindu, the Hungarian, the Semite, the Abyssinian, etc. But then at the back of the Library of Congress, you have a series of five heads. And these five heads are five African people. The numerical significance of these heads is the placement of three, four, five heads, which speaks to the Pythagorean triangle. But they also speak to, numerically, they speak to the origins of mankind. The number five is the number that represents man. Validation of that is that the stars on the flags of the United States are five-pointed stars. The number five represents man because man has five parts on his body, a head, two arms, two legs. So the five-pointed stars on the 55-pointed stars on the flag of the United States of America represent the people of the 50 states which comprise the United States of America. And actually, we'll find the earliest reference to a five-pointed star can be traced back to the Nile Valley. So the number five represents man, and we find the only placement of five heads in the Library of Congress is of five heads of Africans. So in 1897, they were acknowledging in stone that Africans were the true mother and father of humanity. Africans were the original human beings on the planet. And right across the street from the Thomas Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress is the annex, which is now known as the John Adams Building of the Library of Congress. And there are three doorways that take you into that building, and surrounding each doorway are a series of glyphs, patterns, that tell the story of the beginning of culture and civilization, beginning in the East, then moving into the West, and then coming here to America. And the very beginning of the story, the Addix was created in 1939, and the story of the beginning of humanity coincides wonderfully with the story of the beginning of mankind on the back of the Thomas Jefferson building. And the story says that humanity, the culture and civilization began in the Nile Valley, began in Africa. And they very clearly in stone tell the story of Asar, Aset, and Heru, the founding parents of Nile Valley culture and civilization of ancient Kemet. They show a Tekken, which represents the resurrection of Asar, and all of the things that we talk about in our work of the African origins of culture and civilization. So this knowledge, or these secrets, if you will, brother, are literally hidden in plain sight, waiting for people with a proper level of awareness to correctly interpret so that they can understand the story that is literally carved in stone. As Earth, Wind & Fire is saying at the top of this show, the story that is carved in stone, waiting for those with eyes to see, to understand what their ancestors want them to know.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, I think we may have a caller on the line that has a question or a comment for you, so we're going to welcome them. Caller.
Please, hello? Hello?
Okay, I'm not sure. Is the caller there?
Yes, hello?
Okay.
Yes, go ahead, brother. I can hear you.
Peace, Hotep. How are
yes,
you?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, we're fine. How are you?
Peace, I'm excellent. Thank you. I had a question and a comment. That's all right. I had a privilege to go on the D.C. trip twice. With Middlesex County College when I was going there in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I definitely want to say it was a life-changing tour. And I just recently graduated.
Well, brother, first of all, if you went on the activity, you know it's not a tour, correct? I want to jog your memory.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's okay. We just want to keep the information flowing in the right direction.
Yes. My question was, well, first I wanted to share a story with you. Right before I left, we didn't have enough time to check out the heads, which you were talking about. And it reminded me of when I went back. I went back the day we had to leave, and I was back there, and I saw the African heads facing east, if I'm correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, the security guard, he was like, why are you back here? And he's like, there's nothing here. And it was an interesting thing. And he shared with me, he was just asking me about it, telling me about, like, underground trains that they have down there. But I just found it deep, and it was a life-changing experience just to see, you know, statues of us. And my question I just recently graduated Rutgers University about 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I double majored in Africana Studies and Cultural Anthropology. Hmm. And I wanted to know, what do you think for a young brother like me, how would I get into telling our story, and where would I start from this area?
Well, brother, I would really encourage you to come to Egypt and participate in our dig. That would give you an opportunity to do what very few archaeologists have done: put your hands in the soil in an active mm-hmm. excavation of a tomb in Egypt. I mean, you would be able to do something that probably none of your professors have ever done. We are currently making this this opportunity available to people. Well, you know, unfortunately, the deadline for this year's mission was last Friday. We work under the auspices of the Egyptian government, so we're taking a group of 36 people over this year, in addition to a group of professors and students from Morehouse who will be traveling with us during the month of July. But I encourage you to go to our website, which is asarestorationproject.com, asarestorationproject.com, and submit an application for next year. The deadline is always January the 20th for the mission of that year. So I would encourage you to save your money and to follow the work that we're doing and join us next year. That would be a life-changing experience for you, and would also give you a wonderful experience to put on your resume. But I have one question for you, if I may.
Absolutely.
Are you still there?
Thank you. Yes, I am.
Okay. You mentioned that you graduated with a degree in anthropology from Rutgers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How well known on the Rutgers campus is the work of Dr. Ivan Van Sertima?
I'll tell you this. I went there thinking, you know, that I would find there's Africana studies, there's Black studies majors who have never heard his name, ever.
Exactly.
I would say, you know, I wanted to do an honors thesis on, you know, on our past, and they said they haven't hired anybody since Ivan Van Sertima, it's not there at all.
Right. I mean, thank you for verifying what I know to be a fact and what fuels me to do the work that I'm doing. There are people right now in academia who don't want this information to be taught, who don't want it to be known. We find that many commercial and cable television programs continue to present a false representation of Nile Valley history and culture. And it's the same. It is academic apartheid. It is a form of mental enslavement. And the only way that people can continue to get away with that is if they go unchallenged. So, you know, you as a graduate of Rutgers, you know, I would think on one very basic level, you have grounds to sue the university for miseducation. For not teaching you knowledge that Dr. Ivan Van Sertima spent decades teaching and defending at Rutgers University. And like so many of our great scholars, they are voices crying in the wilderness, and once they die, evidence of their presence on their campus is eliminated, such that those who come to that campus a decade after they're gone won't even know that they even existed. And that's a shame. It truly is.
Absolutely. Wow. That is a shame. Well, thank you, caller. Thank you for calling in. And be sure, again, to go to asarestorationproject.com because I think it's certainly wonderful guidance that Baba Browder is giving you. That's an opportunity of a lifetime. But obviously, we have to certainly be prepared well in advance, as this is something that happens, rather, I guess, annually. Is that correct, Brother Browder? Is this annually?
Yes. Our excavation season is May through August, and we are actually taking groups over throughout the month of July and August. We've got at least three missions that are planned, three two-week missions. We are soliciting volunteers to come and assist us in the in cataloging, doing photography, and data entry of the thousands of artifacts that we find every year.
Excellent. It sounds like a profound opportunity.
So thank you, brother, and congratulations on your degree as well, and certainly continue to shine light in these corners where we're certainly, as Baba Browder said, you know, many would like for us to forget or never even discover to begin with.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for motivating me tonight to be better. So thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. And don't get discouraged.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. So this brings me to a question. You know, as my work, as we've talked about a bit tonight, centers around bringing more illumination to what the Maya had tapped into in relationship with these universal factors, these numbers, and what that means as it regards 2012. The question I'd like to ask you, particularly as it relates to the work of Ivan Van Sertima, Brother Browder, is what is, through your knowledge, what is the relationship between Kemet and the people of the Maya era? Because I know there's a definitive relationship there.
Sure. As Dr. Van Sertima has pointed out in his research, in his landmark publication, They Came Before Columbus, The African Presence in America, and the Journal of African Civilizations, he documented many excursions from the Nile Valley into Central America, into Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and he was able to show that these Africans, who were referred to as the Omec, brought with them knowledge, science, religion, and technology, which profoundly influenced the indigenous inhabitants of that land, the Maya, as well as the Aztecs. And so you'll find a number of similarities in the orientation of their temples and their pyramids. You'll find similarities in the construction of their tombs. There are also similarities in some of the rituals that were performed by the Maya priests as well as the Kemetic priests. They appear to be wearing similar clothing, a leopard or jaguar apparel. They also hold similar instruments that are used in rituals for the deceased. And there are similar patterns in the glyphs that were used by both people. What's really interesting, I had the opportunity of traveling to Mexico on five occasions to visit some of these sites. And one of those trips was with Dr. Van Sertima, where we visited on two separate occasions the home of Alexander von Wutenau, who was a German expatriate and a collector of ancient art from Mesoamerica. And Dr. Van Wutenau had one of the largest collections of Olmec terracotta heads in the world. So we were blessed to be able to visit his home, to see his private collection, to see artifacts that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that many of these people who are classified as Olmec were in fact from Africa. Now let me be very clear that based on the evidence of these people who were called the Olmec, some in fact were African in appearance, others appeared to be Asian, and so we can't say categorically that all of these people were African, but we do know that Africans made journeys to the Americas between 900 and 600 BCE. So we're talking 2,700 years before Christopher Columbus came to the New World. Africans had already been here and left evidence of their presence.
Mm-hmm.
What's also significant about the last migrations or last journeys of these Africans from the Nile Valley into Central America is that these last journeys took place during the time of the Kushite presence in ancient Kemet. So, I mean, you know, there's so many things waiting to be interpreted, waiting to be studied, that will reveal much more knowledge of an African and Mesoamerican connection. One of the things that I saw that was quite interesting, quite revealing, in a small museum in the city of Jalapa in Mexico. Actually, what's interesting, that museum was designed by, it's a wonderful museum, an incredibly designed museum, that was designed by the same architect who designed the Nubia Museum in Aswan, Egypt. But inside of the Jalapa Museum, which has one of the it has one of the largest collections of Olmec heads in one location. As you come into the museum, there is there are these words that are carved above the entrance that take you into the hallway where these Olmec heads are found. And this text reads, "Attention, Mexicans. This is the root of your history, its cradle and its altar. Listen to the most silent voices of the most ancient culture in Mexico, the mother of the civilization of our continent. The Olmec converted rain into harvest, the sun into a calendar, stone into sculpture, cotton into cloth, pilgrimage into commerce, mountains into thrones, jaguars into religion, and men into gods." So the indigenous people of that land acknowledged the Olmecs, acknowledged the Africans, who bestowed upon them this technology. They didn't come as invaders or conquerors. They shared their wisdom, which allowed a flourishing of culture and science here in the New World, and they acknowledged their African brothers. So this is a part of world history that all of us have been cheated out of, because we're taught that the presence of foreigners into this new world did not begin until Christopher Columbus accidentally stumbled upon this land. And then what followed was centuries of genocide and the extermination of a culture, of a people. And we're still trying to pick up the pieces of the past and understand what others don't want us to know.
Absolutely. Well, I certainly thank you for the illumination as it relates to that relationship, because, you know, naturally with the work that I've been doing, you know, that's one of those aspects of the work that needs to come more into the light, are the origins and the roots and the reverence and appreciation that the indigenous of Mesoamerica have for their forebears, for those contributors. That the Olmecs did not arrive as conquerors, they arrived as contributors to help civilizations flourish. And that's a very important distinction to be made there. I certainly have appreciated the relationship of the 360-day plus 5-day purification cycle that's related to the ancient ones of Kemp, and seeing a similar thing in the Mayan culture as the Hobbes cycle, the cycle of 360 days plus 5 days purification that happens annually. It's a very important relationship there. I would like to know and ask again, in fact, where is that description that you just shared with us, the writing above the door?
It is in the main hall of the Jalapa Museum in Jalapa, Mexico. Right. It's very much off the beaten path. on the trips, the several trips that I made to Mexico, we had a wonderful tour organizer from New York, Aramitha Grant, who knew the territory. And took us to all of the key places in Mexico where the Olmec live. And this was a wonderful, wonderful museum. And again, you'll find in the Jalapa Museum, in La Venta, in Tuxtla, in Mexico City, you'll find these incredible heads of these Africans known as the Olmec, who traveled to what is now known as Mexico, and brought with them this cargo of knowledge, which jump-started culture and civilization within this land. And you'll see some of these heads are over 7 feet tall, over 15 feet in diameter, and have very distinct African features. There is a head in Tuxtla, I believe, that even has, it's in Tres Deportes. There's a head that has cornrows, 7 braids hanging off the back of this incredibly carved head of an African. And what is interesting that I noticed upon returning to Mexico to visit these sites several times over a number of years, that some of the heads are curiously missing their noses. Portions of the lips have been destroyed. You'll find this a similar type of destruction in Egypt, where I dare say maybe 70% of ancient statues that were created in Kemet before Kemet became Egypt, before 332 BCE, you'll find 70% of the statues created during this time are missing heads, noses, and lips. And the statues in which you will find the images of the so-called Egyptian rulers intact were those images of the Greco-Roman rulers of Egypt who lived between 332 and 33 B.C. That is where you can make a clear historical and cultural distinction between Egypt and Kemet. It's as distinct as the difference, my brother, between the United States of America and whatever this land was called before Christopher Columbus came here.
Indeed, Turtle Island, but certainly some names by those who were here well before.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Napoleon complex of sorts, something going
on
there.
A Napoleon complex, a Hitler complex, but that's what conquerors do. They destroy people, they destroy science, books, and they take everything and then rewrite history to favor them. I mean, this is nothing new. It's been happening for thousands and thousands of years. And we just have to be honest with ourselves and the people who are the current controllers of knowledge also need to be honest. And if they're not going to be honest, they need to be held accountable for what they have done in writing groups of people, millions of people, out of their own history. But fortunately, I think, what's beautiful about all of this madness of 2012, I think metaphorically it does represent the end of the world of European domination of interpreting the histories of indigenous people, and many indigenous people now
That's
having
right.
the opportunity to tell their own truth. And it's time for the truth to be laid on the table. Everyone has their own truth. There's the truth. There is the whole truth, and there is nothing but the truth. And it's by putting all of these truths out there in the public and allowing people to read and examine and discuss them for themselves that we can come to a better understanding of what is in tune with nature, what is in tune with God, what is in tune with our basic spirit, so that we can restore order in the world, restore ma'at in the world, and save this planet before it is destroyed by greedy, selfish megalomaniacs.
Absolutely. Well said, and thank you very much. I wanted to ask you, in fact, I mean, as a renowned author, obviously a scholar, a researcher, and now one who is navigating and fostering archaeological digs, what can we expect from you in the near future? Is there another book on the horizon? I know you're obviously quite busy. It takes time to write books. But what can we expect from Brother Tony Browder in the near future?
Well, we are continuing our excavation. And what we will do at the end of every season, we will publish an account of what we've discovered. So in May of last year, we published a book entitled Finding Karaka Moon, which documents the research that has been done at that site It's referred to technically as TT223, Theban Tomb 223, which is where we're excavating, and we give an accounting of that. We also are in the process of documenting this work through DVDs, and so we have a new DVD that will be coming out next month, in which we've shared new research of our discovery. We've got a host of new discoveries that are waiting for us this summer, so we'll have more information to write about. I'm actually doing a little work now on the Tuskegee Airmen. I've got a show that I'll be hosting tomorrow on WPFW, a local radio station, where we're interviewing a couple of Tuskegee Airmen, and we're talking about, we're using the film Red Tails as a jumping off point to have a more in-depth conversation about what the soldiers refer to as a double victory. The soldiers and African Americans in 1940s America referred to as a double victory, a victory abroad fighting fascism and a victory at home fighting racism. This is a part of the story that, of course, was too detailed to detail in the film Red Tails, but the film affords us an opportunity to have a discussion with brothers who lived that experience. And so we're going to be conducting some interviews with these brothers and creating some other venues where this wonderful aspect of American history, of African-American history, can be discussed throughout the upcoming Black History Month. And, you know, who knows? We'll be doing some other things as well. I'm a very avid fan of films, a critic of films and how we are portrayed in films. So I'll be doing more lectures and presentations on that subject matter as well. And I'm just open to be used as an instrument of enlightenment and transformation. Did we lose the connection? I can't hear you. I guess we did.
Okay, so it does appear we lost the connection a little bit. But I want to thank Brother Tony Browder for being on the show, and if he's able to hear the very end here, we were nearing the end of the show. But what I'd like to do, it looks like we might have him back on. Are you there, Brother Browder?
I sure am. Not quite sure at what point you lost me. Yeah.
Well, no, it's the joy of Wi-Fi connections internationally.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of, we're learning how to do this production. Better and better all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, brother, I really want to acknowledge you and thank you for taking this research to the next level. I'm always an advocate of using whatever we have at our disposal, using the technology at our disposal, and I'm appreciative of what you're able to do. You're in Vancouver, British Columbia. Sitting
yes,
in a cafe with your Macintosh computer, streaming this conversation all around the world. And, you know, I love it. I appreciate it, man. So, you know, you just keep doing what you're doing, brother.
Well, thank you. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to be with us on Sound Synchronicity tonight. And hopefully we can have you back again. I'd certainly love to help let people know more about the important work you're doing, the legacy of the work of many great ones who've come before us. And so thank you very much. And also, I'd like to go ahead and end the show tonight with a particular song, one that you brought back to my consciousness entitled Good Thoughts, Bad Thoughts, if that's all right with you.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yes, sir. Well, certainly, thank you so much. Peace and blessings to your family. And I look in touch with you in the near future. And many, many other wonderful things to come. Thank you for all that you have been doing and continue to do on behalf of in the United States of America and all people everywhere. Your work is truly appreciated.
Well, thank you. And if I could say before I leave, I want to encourage people to go to our website, ASARestorationProject.com, see what we're doing, make a contribution, support our work so that we can continue to tell our story.
Absolutely. And we'll be sure to share that link and that web link far and wide, and certainly encourage people to make financial contributions, because this work does need to be financed. We know that it's not being financed, more than likely not being financed by large commercial interests, because this is the kind of information that, you know, many would rather keep under wrap. But we certainly will do whatever we can to bring it to the light that it deserves, because it's that time. So
appreciate
thank you, Baba.
It.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And we'll talk with you very soon. Enjoy this funkadelic number right here, and you be well.
All right. Thank you, brother. All right. Be safe. Peace.
Peace and love.
problem. The answer is in every question. Dig it? An attitude is all you need to rise and walk away. Inspire yourself. Your life is yours. It fits you like your skin.
You are listening to Sound Synchronicity.